fortified homes that were damaged, the losses were less costly on average. It shows that as climate change brings more extreme storms, investments in strengthening homes can pay off for homeowners and the insurance industry. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. For more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Hannah Francis, and Dave Johnson. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Zamone Perez, Mandy Stapleford, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Cheryl Denise.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Today and yesterday are among the hottest days of the year. Many people, especially those without central AC, are looking for respite in Portland's rivers. The cooling resource of the Willamette River is in question as another algae bloom threatens to spill out of the Ross Island Lagoon. Despite the fact that there is currently no warning in place, the lagoon is full of algae. The situation is not safe for dogs and most animals and can create health concerns for humans as well. Ringleader of Portland's HAP, Willie Levinson, says that Selwood Riverfront is still safe at this point, but that could change rapidly.
In 2023, this situation set up very similarly when it seemed stable in the Ross Island Lagoon in terms of the harmful algae bloom, and then a couple hot days, suddenly it just spilled over into the Willamette and caused a recreational advisory from Selwood to Kelly Point Park. So these things can happen quick. With the bloom in the lagoon, this is a particular time to be vigilant with pets. Pets drink river water, it gets on their dander. Harmful algae blooms can kill dogs. So, this is a really important time to be careful of that. And as we'll see on the tour, inside the lagoon, we'll see streaking, we'll see deep coloration and formation of the harmful algae bloom. And then other areas when we come back to Selwood. At this point, Selwood is fine, appears to be fine, but these situations can change very quickly.
Mary Stites is the staff attorney with Northwest Environmental Defense Center, or NEDC.
What makes an algal bloom is a mix of stagnant, turbid water that is loaded with nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen that we get, from people using fertilizer on their lawns, for example, and then really warm temperatures is what allows that bacteria to proliferate in the waterway. So these really, really warm temperatures are a huge contributing factor. And it's rather unfortunate that the warm temperatures are what would compel someone to want to jump in the river on a hot day. It's kind of the opposite side of the same coin of a problem, but the idea was that if we could better control the algal bloom, we could make sure that people could use this as a public health, access to waterways. That was kind of the vision. Mm-hmm.
NEDC won a lawsuit and created a plan to prevent these algae blooms, but there are general concerns about these agreements not being respected.
Yeah, so I guess in April of 2023, we sued the Department of Environmental Quality for their issuance of what's called a water quality certification to Ross Island Sand and Gravel to basically facilitate the ongoing reclamation that has been going on for decades now. That water quality certification is a pretty technical document, but it basically says it's the state's thumbs up that this activity will not further hinder water quality standards. So making sure that the beneficial uses of the waterway, like contact recreation, commercial fishing, for example, those all need to be protected in furtherance of the reclamation plan. So we brought suit against DEQ alleging that the water quality certification wasn't sufficient because it didn't, in the interim, have sufficient monitoring and response protocols, specifically in regards to the harmful algal bloom. And at a very high level, we ended up reaching a settlement with DEQ that basically required them to require Ross Island Sand and Gravel throughout the hot summer months to take certain water quality measurements that help us monitor and better anticipate when the cyanobacteria comes to a level that is harmful to human health and also dogs. And a big crux of that settlement was the requirement that when there is a harmful algal bloom, Ross Island needs to deploy a boom to contain the harmful algal bloom and also skim along the lagoon to make sure that they're collecting that cyanobacteria that then proliferates in these really hot, stagnant conditions that makes it unsafe for us to all swim, and our pets included. So by the looks of it, there is an algal bloom that is proliferating within the lagoon, and it has yet to be deployed. A boom has yet to be deployed. We're not entirely sure what Ross Island's compliance with the ongoing monitoring has been, and that kind of frustrates the entire purpose of the agreement that we reached with DEQ, which was to allow us to be able to be more proactively responsive to avoid a situation where we have an algal bloom that spills out into the Willamette and eventually reaches Cathedral Park, for example, like we've seen in years past.
I have a number of questions that I'd like to have answers to. I don't understand why there's not a harmful algae bloom advisory in the lagoon. I don't understand why it hasn't happened earlier in the season. NEDC negotiated a very strong settlement with DEQ that can trigger a trigger Ross Island Sand and Gravel to mechanically skim the surface and put up a boom to contain the harmful algae bloom in the lagoon. That can only happen when there's an OHA advisory. OHA advisories can be done from cell density. That is a threshold that could have been met a month ago. So it's very frustrating that they didn't utilize that tool that NEDC worked so hard to do, because that ultimately is something that would be already paid. It would not cost the public. Ross Island Sand and Gravel is required to do this, but not until there's an advisory. I'd like to have an answer to what the governor's office plan is to fix this problem. This is something Human Access Project has been working on with Oregon State University and a broad group of stakeholders since 2017. We are a 1.5 person nonprofit. We should not have the burden of driving this. We have been driving it since 2017. We've fundraised close to $1 million to bring a solution to this problem. Through very hard work, we have done a $150,000 advanced hydraulic model that proves proof of concept that was peer reviewed by two academic institutions that putting in a channel will solve this problem. We've fundraised $500,000. It took us 2 years to do this, to do 30% engineering of this channel, which will be complete earlier this year. Then we brought House Bill 3314 to the legislature this year that would have allowed us to continue our work, and it didn't pass. Finally through the House, it got a 9-0 bipartisan vote in the Water Committee with a very strong recommendation, and then it died in the House Ways and Means. So I just would really like to know what the governor's office plan is to fix this problem. I have run out of patience. My superpower is patience. I have been working on this since 2017. What needs to happen happen in our mind is there's a program with the governor's office called Regional Solutions. My experience with working with the state bureaucracy, which isn't necessarily a knock on the state bureaucracy, all the people who I work with at all these different agencies are human beings that are interested in solving this problem. What I saw from the very beginning is that none of these agencies had the budget to address it, and none of them wanted to own it. So we just took a leadership role and relied on cooperation from these various agencies to move the project forward. But now, you know, we need to have coordination from the state. So the way I like to describe it is that, number one, the state has jurisdiction over this space. Oregon Health Authority is like an arm. DEQ is like an arm. DEQ is a leg. DSL is a leg. Department of State Lands, Department of Environmental Quality. But it's missing a brain. That is what the governor's office does. Through the Regional Solutions Program, they do a deep due diligence of a particular issue. The governor's office is able to develop a plan, and then you put a brain on the body, and the governor's office can direct all these different body parts how to move. I've been talking to Regional Solutions for the last 2 years to engage them, and at this point, I feel like I'm being handled. I do not like that I keep getting put off with answers that make no sense. So I'm very interested to hear what the governor's office plan is for bringing a solution to this, because ultimately, this is a public health issue. It's something that kills dogs. It's a water quality issue, and it will be an anchor around the neck of a downtown recovery.
The whole point of this lawsuit and a lot of our work with Human Access Project has been to make sure that the Willamette River can be a resource on these really hot days for pets and for people. And we were really proud of the work that we did with DEQ to implement a plan that not only allowed for us to better project when a harmful algal bloom would occur, but would allow us to respond very quickly so that the algal bloom could be contained. The fact that it doesn't seem as though that is happening at the detriment to Portland dogs, Portland Willamette River users, and all of Oregon Willamette River users is very frustrating, because we are enduring a heat wave right now and people are not assured that they can safely swim in the river.
HAP and their associates have done extensive research into finding a solution to this issue, and now only need political and financial support to make it happen.
So ultimately, the long-term plan, and this is something that we worked on since 2017, is putting a channel through the lagoon. Ross Island Lagoon used to be two separate islands with a flow in between. In 1926, the Army Corps of Engineers put in an earthen dam to facilitate transportation through the islands, but it also, for Ross Island Sand and Gravel, who happened to buy the island that exact same year, could remove gravel. So as gravel was removed from the lagoon to build Portland, Ross Island Lagoon slowly but surely turned into a 140-acre stagnant pond inside of a river. So the solution is not very imaginative. It's just reopening the channel that was blocked off in 1926. Anytime a harmful algae bloom forms in a river, it's typically the result of bad human behavior. It's more typical for harmful algae blooms to form in reservoirs and lakes. It does not take a lot of water movement to break up harmful algae bloom. And ultimately, by putting in a channel, it will break up the retention time of the bloom, push it downstream, and not allow it to organize. That is ultimately, I mean, hydraulically speaking, Ross Island Lagoon is a 140-acre stagnant pond inside of a river. So, in early 2026, we are going to deliver 30% design. And again, why Human Access Project has had to take the initiative on this when we are a 1.5-person nonprofit, and why the state isn't taking the lead is really starting. I'm just really interested to know what the state's answer is for why Human Access Project is having to drive this work of something that impacts the large, most populous city in the state of Oregon.
Do you think they're hiding behind their bureaucracy to not have to complete anything?
I'd be really interested to know what the state's answer is to those questions.
You guys have asked all my questions.
I'm good.
I didn't have any other notes here.
I think anything else.
Anything else you want to add?
Yeah.
Can you say what you'd like to make?
So NEDC's lawsuit, you know, part of this reclamation plan is that Ross Island Sand and Gravel is being required to undo the work, the damage that they've done to the lagoon by removing all of this aggregate. And part of that is reclaiming shallow water habitat. So NEDC came in, and really, it doesn't take a PhD to understand this. If you take a pond and you make it more shallow, it will get warmer. That is really the basis of the NEDC lawsuit. And in the same way, you don't have to be a PhD to understand that, you don't have to be an MBA to see that Ross Island Sand and Gravel is a sinking ship. We need to have a game plan of what we're going to do when they go out of business, because it may not happen, but the tea leaves are saying that could happen. And when these things happen, things move really quickly. If Regional Solutions is engaged and the governor's office is able to develop a strategy, I would just assume it's going to take 9 months to a year just to get all of those needs reconciled to be able to come up with a game plan. Because ultimately, how are you able to negotiate with an entity when you have four different body parts that aren't coordinated with a particular strategy? If we are going to have a successful negotiation with Ross Island Sand and Gravel, the state's got to get their game plan together. The state does not have a game plan that I've seen. We did make an effort to pass House Bill 3314, and I would like to thank all of the state representatives and senators that did support this bill. We had a lot of local support for this bill.
Mary with NEDC has more thoughts on what long-term outcomes could look like.
Yeah, so, I mean, for next year, we, what we consider to be the robust conditions that were included in this water quality certification as a result of our lawsuit were biweekly monitoring through the summer months. And then, yeah, when the cyanobacteria reaches a level that is of health concern, they were supposed to deploy the boom. What we're seeing is the level of bacteria has been growing over the course of a couple of weeks, and we thought that the conditions would have been sufficient to anticipate that, and we were anticipating that this was going to happen. And why OHA and DEQ didn't, you know, ping Ross Island to say, all right, it's coming and it's going to get hotter, get the boom ready, is news to me. I don't know why that is happening. It is, again, frustrating the purpose and the intent of the lawsuit itself, or the settlement itself. But we are hopeful that we can come to DEQ and say, hey, this is not what the settlement agreement contained, and what do we need to do to make sure that this doesn't happen again next summer, because we want people to be able to swim on the hottest days safely.
For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to today's American Community Media Weekly National Briefing. I'm Pilar Marrero, your moderator for today and co-producer of our weekly Friday briefings with my colleague Sunita Sorachi. After nearly 2 years of war between Israel and Hamas, Gaza is in ruins. Over 60,000 people have been killed, 18,000 of them children, according to UNICEF. The majority of Gaza's 2 million residents have been displaced, left without home, clean water, or consistent access to food. For months, many have faced what international agencies now describe as catastrophic levels of hunger. Despite repeated denials by Israeli officials, the global consensus is clear: Gaza is on the brink of famine. Religious leaders, humanitarian groups, and global heads of state, including even President Donald Trump, have acknowledged that starvation is taking place. UNICEF, the UN Fund for Children's Emergencies, last week called for more humanitarian and commercial traffic to come into Gaza, calling for flooding the strip with supplies, using all channels and all gates to combat the spiraling death rates that accompany the aid blockades, the war, and the hunger. Our speakers today are Alex DeWall. He's executive director of the World Peace Foundation, expert on famine and mass atrocity. And he's also a research professor at Tufts University. Budur Hassan, she's Amnesty International's researcher on Israel and Palestine. And Afif Nisuli, he's a journalist and aid worker, just returned from 9 weeks volunteering in Gaza. Today, we are pleased to welcome Alex DeWall. He's executive director of the World Peace Foundation, a professor at Tufts University, and he's an expert in famine. We are very lucky to have him. He's a very important expert. Welcome, Mr. DeWall. For those of us who don't know how this process of a whole society, when a whole society is unable to get enough food, can you explain how Gaza came to this point, where people, particularly children, the frail, and the old, are starving?
So thank you for inviting me to this. It's good to be with you. I'm sorry that it's such a dismal subject to talk about. And for those of you who are from Gaza or have relatives there, my condolences, my commiserations for the suffering that your families are going through. So before October of 2023, the situation in Gaza was unusual. The nutrition and health status of the population was generally good. You didn't have large numbers of malnourished children. You had high rates of vaccination, high rates of health coverage. But you had a situation in which the population of about 2 million people was almost entirely dependent upon supplies of food, medicine, water, fuel, etc., that were under the control of Israel. There was very little food that was actually produced within Gaza. After October the 7th, Israel did two things. It put a complete siege on Gaza, not allowing anything in for the first 7 weeks. And after that, a partial siege, allowing some food and other commodities in day by day, varying the amount that it would allow in. And it also launched a military campaign from the air and on the ground that attacked and destroyed objects indispensable to survival. And that is a key term, because in international law, the prohibition on starvation is not food as such. It is defined as objects indispensable to survival. That includes food, water, sanitation, housing, medical care, etc. And there was mass displacement. There were evacuation orders for the population, so people had to leave their homes and were crowded into areas that were desperately overcrowded. Now, for the 13 months from November of 2023 to December of 2024, we have data from a mechanism. It's called the IPC, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification System. It was set up just over 20 years ago by the United Nations to measure the level of humanitarian need in crisis-affected areas. And it draws on three different types of data. Food security data, that is what people are eating and what they are doing in order to eat that food. Child malnutrition and evidence for excess deaths. And it has five levels. So normal, stressed, crisis, emergency, and then the worst level, famine or catastrophe. And what we saw between November of 2023 and December of 2024 was the population going right up to the famine level, but not quite breaking it. And on several occasions when the IPC, and there's an American equivalent called FuseNet, the Famine Early Warning System Network, when the IPC and FuseNet warned that these famine thresholds were about to be broken, the United States pushed Israel to provide more assistance and kept it just below that threshold. I would also add that Israel did not permit the collection of all the data that is necessary. So in not allowing journalists in there and not allowing humanitarian workers to collect all the data, it could play the game with the data and prevent information from being available to give that famine determination. Now, what we've had in the last few months is a worsening of this. So a complete siege, so a complete collapse in food availability. And that began at the beginning of March. And in the middle of May, some food was allowed in. But by that time, the food stocks had got so low that you needed not only to give enough food to feed everyone, you really needed to give more. And one of the reasons for that is that there's always an unequal distribution of food. It's the poorest 20%, the poorest quarter, that are really at risk. And they are the last ones to get food from the market or general distribution. So what we've seen in the last few months is really a catastrophic decline. And the IPC system, what they actually said a couple of weeks ago, I forget, 10 days ago now, was they said the worst case scenario of famine is unfolding. And what they meant by that was we don't actually have the precise data, but we are sufficiently experienced in observing these situations to infer from the data that we have that this is what is happening. It is like when you walk into to meet your doctor and you have a high fever, the doctor doesn't need to send for the tests to ascertain that you are very sick. He or she can give the diagnosis right there. So the last point I'll make now is that what you see in these situations is it gets worse and worse and worse gradually, and then it escalates. And we're at that point of escalation. And what I fear is that as that escalation kicks in, as the numbers of children in particular who are starving increase so rapidly every day, it will be that much harder to stabilize the situation, to return it to normal.
Thank you, Mr. DeWall. I know that at this point, there was a 2 months of blockade between March and May, right? Where they were not allowing anything in. And then due to international pressure, I guess, they created this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that is distributing food. But this is a Israel-US institution or whatever you want to call it. So it hasn't really worked out too well, has it?
So it's not a system that any professional humanitarian would set up. So the basic principle of a humanitarian operation is that you take assistance to where people are and you provide the most needy with what they most need. And you particularly target children. And what the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has done is the United Nations had about 400 locations, and it had a reliable system. So that system allowed people, gave people the confidence that they, even if they were not getting food today, they would get it tomorrow, because the system was embedded with the community. What the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has is four sites, and they are far away. Particularly three of them are in the far south of Gaza, and they are far away, and people have to go there. And the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation calls them secure distribution sites. Well, they are secure only insofar as the items are secure up to the point where they reach that place. There is no security for the people. More than 800 have been killed in trying to get it. I can't tell you whether they've been killed deliberately or it's simply a matter of when you have these huge crowds of people rushing to get the food from a place that is only open for a few minutes. If you have a soldier nearby, he doesn't know who's in that crowd. It could be Hamas. And they can easily panic. Or the mercenaries, the private security contractors there could also panic. And so the poor and vulnerable cannot get this food. It's the strong that get the food. And one point I think is very crucial about this, which is that Israel says it set this up because it did not want Hamas to get its hands on food. Now, and it had been alleging for months that Hamas was stealing food. We know from US government investigations that Hamas was not stealing food at scale. I'm sure that individual Hamas members may have been eating it, but they were not taking it at scale. The US has its reports on that. The New York Times called up Israeli colonels, senior military officers, and they confirmed this. And the UN had a system of very close tracking of all its aid commodities that would ensure they reached the people, including following up. Now, if you look at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and you look at the young men who are storming those places to take the food, nobody knows who they are. They could be Hamas, they could be armed gangs. And what this tells me is either this is really just frankly incompetent, or Israel doesn't care about this issue of Hamas taking food. There is some other reason behind it. I can't answer that question. But I think if you've talked to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, one question you must ask is, who is eating your food? Because I don't believe they can answer that question.
For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon. Go Ducks!
One thing I hear from so many of my ADHD students all the time,